ya lo hace, pierna derecha, directo al arco, ¡golazo! ¡Golazo!
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Thursday, January 9th, 2020. I'm Kevin Larame, joined by Dwayne Mullins. As always, to start the show today, joining us live from Minnesota, Jeff Reuter of The Athletic, to talk about a great article that came out on Monday that talks about the lack of player movement between the USL and Major League Soccer. But first of all, how are you, Jeff, today?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me, and Happy New Year. Don't think I've talked to you yet in 2020.
No, 2020. Still getting used to writing that. I had to type it in an article today, and it felt weird. But anyway... Jeff, let's start with this. I mean, you outlined pretty well in the article, which you can read on The Athletic, of course, how there has been, you know, remarkably few paid transfers into MLS from USL, USL Championship, USL League One. Beyond just MLS refusing to pay transfer fees to leagues that they perceive as lower than them, which I think we all understand is probably part of the issue, beyond that, why is it? Is there an underlying reason for this resistance?
Well, it's interesting. You bring up that, I mean, obviously the USL pyramid, doesn't matter which league you look at, is going to be a lesser level than Major League Soccer. I think that's a given, and I think even the most ardent supporters of the lower leagues are going to agree with that. But the weird thing is, Major League Soccer is not afraid to pay transfer fees to lower divisions in the sense of, like, Finland. Any of the Scandinavian leagues, any of the, you know, obviously Brazil and Argentina is going to be as good, if not better, than Major League Soccer at this stage. But Colombia, there's a lot of transfer fees that go into there, Uruguay, Chile. So it's not like a blanket statement of unless the league is better than Major League Soccer. So then you're looking at other perceptions of scouting attentiveness. I think that there's a lot of MLS clubs that worry that their fans are going to overreact to signing a player from the second division and say, oh, why didn't you get that guy for free either last winter, or why didn't you draft that player? Why did he slip through the cracks? Which just isn't realistic. I don't know a single person who reacts to signing a player who's developed as a professional over the last 2 years by getting regular game time as saying, oh, that's your fault. I've never heard that reaction, but that's something that a lot of clubs have indicated to me in the past. So go figure with that. Otherwise, I think that there's just a part where MLS loves a free player. And if they have to pay a transfer fee for anybody, they're going to look for the free option instead. They would also rather go with someone who's maybe played 100 or made 100 lineups or 100 game day rosters, even if they haven't made an appearance in Major League Soccer, over somebody who's been playing the last 3 years starting every week for, like, the Pittsburgh Riverhounds, for example. The fact that the USL Defender of the Year, and when you look at these players, by the way, and you're looking at the back half of an MLS roster that need domestic players, you're thinking defense, you're thinking goalkeepers, you're not necessarily thinking attackers. But the USL Defender of the Year, Joe Greenspan, didn't get a single offer from Major League Soccer and ended up signing with San Diego Loyal. Why is that? That just doesn't make any sense to me. So I think that there's a lot of ego at play with this, with Major League Soccer. And anytime they see a Mark Anthony Kay, they treat it like it's a one-off instead of a trend.
Fair enough. We're, of course, talking to you today about an hour and a half from the start of the Super Draft, or the Super Conference Call, as we're choosing to call it now. At any rate, do you think some of the resistance is a fear that some of these players that they can sort of control through a draft mechanism might choose instead to go to USL with the hope that they could get, do a couple years at that level and then be sold into MLS? Do you think there's a resistance there, like a control resistance?
Yeah, it's a good question, because under the current CBA, and I'm guessing, as far as I know, this isn't a major sticking point for the ongoing negotiations. Teams have 4 years of control over draft picks. So if it's a second round pick or later, or like a late first round pick, it's 1 year guaranteed with three options. And then for usually like the top 15 or 20 picks, it's 2 year guarantee with two options. So there's obviously control that comes with that compared to signing a player on the free market. The thing is, drafted players are already in contact with USL clubs. I mean, I can tell you right now about a couple dozen, well, I won't tell you, but I could tell you about like a couple of dozen potential draft picks who have already been in communication with the USL, who have hey, if you fall out of the top 12, if you fall out of the first round, if you get told that you have to go to training camp and you're only going to be the 28th guy on the roster and you'd rather get some minutes, come give us a call. We'll be able to give you a contract. And I know that that's been going on for a few years now. There's a few clubs in particular who've been very good about kind of cornering that portion of the market. But this just goes back to, I mean, like you said, it's the Super Conference call. It's not the draft. And so it's an event that is already taking a lesser status than it certainly did 10 years ago before allocation money and before academy systems were getting so developed. I think a lot of clubs, if you're looking at like a Houston Dynamo, if they're drafting a player, it's a stash player for Rio Grande Valley. If you're looking at Real Salt Lake, it's rare that they're going to end up anywhere besides Real Monarchs for their first season. So with the affiliate setup, you really are drafting for your USL affiliate at this point.
Many different examples are laid out in your article, Jeff, looking at different players. You mentioned the Defender of the Year last year, and there's other cases that the label of a lower division player, the label of a USL player, is following a lot of talent across the pyramid in North America, and unfortunately they don't get the chance. I'm going to give you one name, and that's one name that I've been looking at for years and years. Christian Valeski, and I still cannot believe no one ever gave him a chance. How do you change the stigma of being labeled a second division player?
You know, actually, Valeski was in preseason with Minnesota United. I think that was 2018. And at the time, Minnesota and St. Louis FC, who he was playing for, were looking at some sort of loose framework for an affiliation partnership that didn't get across the line. So I think what they saw at the time is, for Minnesota and Valeski in particular, just because you name-dropped him, they still had Christian Ramirez on the roster. They had Abu Dinladi coming back. They had just drafted Mason Toy. So I think striker wasn't exactly where they needed kind of a second, third-string player, which is what ultimately I think Valeski would be, a very good second-string striker in Major League Soccer. But what does it take to get rid of that stigma? I mean, it sucks, but a big part of it is you just need to get that first division opportunity, right? I think that the longer you play in the second division, the more you have to fight that. You look at a player like Marc-Anthony Kay, and I don't think he was ever really dinged by that, or he was ever really seen as a second division player because he had left Toronto's academy, and he was still a young player by American and Canadian professional soccer standards, that he was still seen as something of a prospect or prospect adjacent. But as you're getting to these guys who are, you know, getting insurance provided by their clubs, so you're looking at the 26-year-olds down in the United States, at least, who aren't on Obamacare anymore, then they are playing at that point because clubs are giving them high enough wages or insurance as well. But the longer that you go on at that, so if you're a player who's played in the USL or used to play in the NASL before that, certainly if you played in the NASL and are still in the USL, you're probably seen as a second division guy. How do you fix that? Well, I mean, frankly, that's a byproduct of a closed system. And these are the very real difficulties in terms of player movement and the player's career trajectory that you have when you don't have promotion relegation in your system, because you don't have a case where Hull City lucks their way into the Premier League for 1 year. Andrew Robertson is in the shop window and suddenly Liverpool sees him when they probably would have looked past a Scottish left back at Hull City. Not exactly the sexiest kind of scouting prospect. You don't have like a Ryan Sessegnon, who is kind of an uber hyped guy, but you got to see him play pretty regularly in the Premier League before Tottenham ultimately jumped. You don't have any sort of instances like that. Instead, what you have is a player who, or a team, if we're just looking at Phoenix Rising, who won 20 games in a row, which has never happened in North America before. It's only a few teams in the world have ever won that many games in a row. And as of right now, not a single player on that roster has gotten an MLS offer. There are two that I've learned of this week who are in early stage talks that may be making that move. So keep a look on my Twitter profile. I'll be reporting those as soon as those get across the line. But the fact that that takes so long, and the fact that it's so rare for a player to make that move up, that's a direct byproduct of the single entity closed system.
Here's a tough question for you, Jeff. And since your article came out on Monday, a few GMs actually contacted you. You can follow Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Rauter to get more details. One thing that is fascinating to me is a lower division player from Norway with the same amount of skills, same amount of talent, but not any preconceived ideas, no prerequisite of having to convince anyone, a passport makes a big difference. Is there a bias, a North American bias against North American players when it comes to soccer still to this day? Do we think that because he has an accent, because his name finishes in a little Latin way, that they're going to be better than maybe a similar talent that has come from a regional, local, municipal association? So here's my question to you. Is there still a bias looking at players from North America versus a similar player from outside?
I would argue so. And I think that if you talk to almost any domestic player, they would say so. Right now, the latest trend has been in the goalkeeper pool, if I'm being honest, because if you look at what have the United States produced better over the last 20 years than any other position relative to the rest of the world, it's absolutely goalkeeping. And yet you're seeing more and more MLS clubs say, hey, let's bring in an international goalkeeper and let's really try to push the level where you have Zach McMath. For, I think, the third straight offseason, getting traded for $50,000 of targeted allocation money. It's just absurd. I think that part of it is just a bias. Part of it is that, I mean, there's a chapter in the book Soccernomics that has been republished three times over where they talk about how, you know, certain countries, like, you want to sign the Brazilian kid instead of signing the Slovakian kid. That's just a given. You're going to want to sign the German defender over the Canadian defender. That's just kind of a sick reality of the transfer market at this point because of reputation. But if you look at it, I mean, like, even over the last 5 years, England has had its player pool in, or its representation in Major League Soccer, really take a nosedive because of the Jay Simpsons of the world, or the John Rooney's, I guess, the players who didn't quite pan out. So, yeah, I do think that there is a preference for the signing where when you announce it, I think this is how they look at it. If you announce that you're signing a 24-year-old left back from Charlotte Independence, your fans are going to be like, oh, okay, well, here's our backup. But if you sign a 24-year-old German left back who has been playing in the second Bundesliga, third Bundesliga pretty regularly, they're going to get excited and they're going to be like, wow, we brought in someone from that. So I think that part of it is also a marketing thing, which is cynical, but I mean, we've been covering these leagues long enough. I think it's pretty fair to call what it is.
Yeah. That this leads sort of into this. I'm going to get you to put a little bit of tinfoil on your head. Not don't cover it entirely, but a little bit. How much do you think there's a directive from above, from the league, to not spend money, to not go over the top, to spend transfers on these guys in an effort? I don't want to say the C word, collusion, but right, I just did. But is there sort of an understanding out there to not do this, do you think, that prevents it?
I don't think that there's some grand plan. No. Even so look, I am probably the most outspoken person on this issue that there is in the country at this point who writes in the media. But even I don't think that there's, you know, all MLS teams getting together and saying, yeah, you know, it would really mess up our pyramid. And make sure that we have, I'm trying to remember what people said in my comment section on The Athletic. I think that there were some people saying it was a way to decentivize USL clubs from signing and developing young players because they won't get any money in, which then means they'll get out of that game and the MLS will take over. Well, that's just not true because at that point, the USL is dead. So they are always going to be in that game. That's just how they're able to find players. But do I think that there is kind of an institutional preference after the last now 25 years of Major League Soccer to say, hey, let's sign other first division players, or let's retread the same players in Major League Soccer before we bring in people from the second division? Yeah, absolutely, I think so. And part of that is, to be fair, the really checkered history and the really fractured past of the second division in U.S. soccer over the last 25 years as well, if you're looking at every single second division league that's come and gone. And how that pyramid has shifted. I think that there's still a lack of trust. But this version of the USL and its current USL pro state is 10 years old. I think at this point you can call it established.
Fair enough. Just a quick comment before my final question. We'll be very curious to see the Canadian Premier League, how it handles out sales to Major League Soccer, if and when that comes. Some rumors about that already. You follow this very closely, as you say, and you know this player pool very well. Is there room out there, realistically, for a very savvy GM, for an open-minded GM, to really work this sort of hole in the system to improve his roster dramatically by finding these hidden gems in USL. Do you think that this is something that a savvy GM could use to their benefit?
Oh, absolutely. And I think if you're looking at my article at The Athletic, you're seeing two GMs or two decision makers at their respective clubs, Dan Egner, the technical director over at Real Salt Lake, and Nicky Budulic, old friend of Canada's, I'm sure, who is now with Inter Miami as the director of soccer operations. Both of them have signed multiple USL players this offseason to their MLS roster. And I think if you're just crunching the numbers here, and I think one thing that another person commenter on The Athletic said was, okay, well, the transfer fee affects their salary budget hit. Not really, because if you're looking 2 years ago, LAFC paid $35,000 for Mark Anthony Kay. So what's the difference in your salary budget realistically from signing a player for $70,000 for the senior minimum in 2019 or $105,000? You can find that space. That's no problem. Or you can use GAM and you can buy that off of your books, and then suddenly you're just paying a $70,000 player. It's not rocket science. It's one of those questions where I keep looking at it, and I've actually asked a couple of GMs, like, is it really this difficult? Is there something I'm not seeing there? And they just say no. We do get it. We can grasp it. These transfer fees, you're not paying $200,000. Maybe if you were trying to poach like Solomon Asante, the defending USL MVP, who's in his prime, he's 28, 29 years old and has some interest from overseas. But he's at an age now where I don't think most MLS clubs would take a look at him. And that's just the reality right now. They would rather sign someone younger they can have for a few years before worrying about a decline. That's fine. But do I think it's a place for a savvy GM to really step in? I think it's good to put a little bit of sobriety into this conversation, because I know I get hyped up about it. You're not necessarily looking for your instant starter. You might find a starting goalkeeper. You might be able to find a starting defender, but you're not looking to fill five of your starting 11. With players who moved up from the USL, that might be a little overwhelming. And frankly, that's something that not even Cincinnati did last year, and Minnesota did in 2017. I think the clubs recognize that. But you do have to fill the back half of your roster. Your back half of your roster is by definition 14 or 15 players. There's no reason that you can't fill two or three of those slots with players who have started 30 games the previous season in the second division, made the postseason possibly, are young enough, and would cost you a five-figure transfer fee and then a salary that's either in the reserve range, depending on their age, if they're 24 or under, or somebody who would come in for that $70,000 or whatever the new CBA negotiates the minimum to be.
Jeff, last question before we say goodbye for today. Looking at the entire picture, looking at the U.S. Soccer, United States Soccer Federation, and the national team picture with this optic of MLS and USL and the lack of player movement, would it be beneficial for United States Soccer and the U.S. Soccer Federation and the U.S. Men's National Team if incentives were put in place for USL players or for MLS team to recruit USL players, because most of the USL players would have been American and would help the player pool and at least diversify it a little bit more? Is there something to be done by U.S. Soccer to either give incentive or facilitate the player movement from USL to Major League Soccer?
So it's a really good question. And I'm trying to figure out if there's a way that this could work, because MLS loves nothing more than coming up with a title for a small pool of money that it gives its clubs to make transactions. It's kind of its favorite thing. But I don't know if there would be a domestic player pool of money that would be made for second division players. If you're looking at the national team, there have been a few examples, I guess, of players getting their 15 minutes of fame after playing in the lower divisions. Miguel Ibarra in 2014 with Minnesota United. Ben Sweat used to play for Tampa Bay Rowdies, worked his way up the pyramid. I think Daniel Lovitz has some second division experience as well. But it's just at that level, I think you're looking much more at the academy system. And you're really questioning if the DA model is working, which in my opinion, it's not, but maybe that's a topic for a different phone call. I think that realistically, look, you're improving the domestic player pool by ensuring that there is upward mobility for players who aren't standout athletes at 16 years old, or who aren't one of the 15 best college kids to graduate or leave college at the right time any given year. Because right now, if you don't fit either of those billing guys, you're out of luck. You're absolutely out of luck. And you're probably going to be going to Europe to a third division club in Germany, hoping that you crack it out of their academy, or you're going to be going to a club in Holland in their academy, and then you get lost in the quagmire of everything in European soccer. And it's just, it's not a sustainable way to ensure that you have more than 40 players ever in your national team's senior pool. So I don't know if there's anything that the Federation would do for it, but make no mistake, if this trend keeps going, it is really going to continue to hurt both the United States and then depending on the player movement in Canada, which is a topic we'll be able to revisit in a few years after the CPL is more established. It's something that really does affect your national team.
Jeff Rudy of The Athletic. You can follow Jeff's work on The Athletic. Great work covering soccer at all levels. Jeff, thank you very much for your time today. And we wish you a great Super Conference call today.
Sounds good, guys. Keep up the good work.
And we'll be right back after this short break.
You are listening to Soccer Today. Follow us on Twitter at @SoccerTodaySPN and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/Sports Podcasting Network. You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.
We're back on Soccer Today. The Two Solitude Soccer Podcast for Patrons Only came out yesterday. You can get access to it for $2 a month at our Patreon page, patreon.com/sportspodcastnetwork. $5 a month will give you access to the breaking news audio, which might see a show today, depending on the news. And also, for $10, you can get access to the documentary tier where Dwayne and I and Carlo Corazon and Jim Brennan look at the 2000 World Cup. Gold Cup in depth. I wish we won the World Cup, Dwayne, but we didn't. But we did win the Gold Cup in 2000. That and more at our Patreon page at patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. A domestic allocation money. That could be called damn. Oh, that would damn be fitting.
Yeah, I was making jokes on Twitter today about Wham and how it's only you could sign left backs that wake you up before you go.
you know, and every Christmas they're like, yeah, last Christmas I gave you my heart. And the very next day.
Exactly. We could go on all day. There's a lot of three-letter words with ham at the end, if it turns out, at any rate.
But damn or damn, because you could probably find a way to put an N in there. Domestic allocation money for national team players. So you can call it damn, D-A-M-N, well, damn.
Well, damn, yeah, that would be damn. We missed him the first time, so there you go.
Which I guess is one of the reasons why you don't see a lot of USL and MLS player movement. People in life, and that's not just in sports, are rarely open about admitting mistakes, and it's the first key to recovery. You should ask a lot of people out there. Never mind denial. Accept that you did something wrong at the beginning, and you can fix it. Accept that you're not going to recruit every good USL players out there because there's 20,000 of them. But accept that when there's a good one coming into your pathway, give him a shot.
No, for sure. And look, it's funny. It's an arbitrary distinction in a lot of ways. You're a player that I, you know, as a person have a lot of time for, that I saw in Toronto for a while and now is in Miami, Jay Chapman. Are you going to tell me that Jay Chapman, who has an MLS contract because he was in the MLS Academy, he sat on the bench for an MLS team, then gets traded to Miami and gets a chance to be an MLS player, is there aren't like 10 of Jay Chapmans in the USL? Are you going to tell me that?
There's like, probably 20. Honest. That's the thing. Like I mentioned Christian Valeski because I saw him score for different teams across the USL for years and years. A goal scorer is a goal scorer. Sometimes it doesn't matter which level. Just ask Jamie Vardy. Do you think Jamie Vardy was looked at a non-conference team as the next big goal scorer in England? No, but he kept on keeping on. He kept on scoring. Scoring is one of these skills that sometimes is not teachable, and you just have it. Wondolowski, he doesn't look like a great goal scorer, and he's actually mentioned in Jeff's article because he used to play in the NPSL, and he got his debut when he got a shot. But a goal scorer is a goal scorer, and there's a ton of goal scorers in the USL. You're going to tell me no one's going to give him a shot when you can save money in a salary cap league where value is necessary? Yeah, it does put myself into a questioning mood. Looking at GMs for the last decade, yeah, they're not looking at their backyard real hard, are they?
No, look, I think Jeff was right to put a little sobriety, as he put it, into the conversation. No, you wouldn't want to put an entire lineup of USL guys because, you know, not that they're completely incompetent about their identification, but I can't help but think if you look at the back end of your bench in particular that there aren't ways to make these teams
a lot more competitive, a lot more professional. And look, you have to balance your long-term development needs. You want to have some room on any roster anywhere in the world where you're going to have players that you know you could get a little bit better, a little bit older, but you're sacrificing that for a longer play.
That's something you're going to do. But as Jeff said, if you're looking for your backup left back or your backup center half or you know, a backup winger or whatever, I'm sure there are players out there. And it just seems odd that there's only been 3 paid transfers in 11 years from USL to MLS. That, you know, I don't want to say collusion because that is probably not what's happening, but there is definitely a bias.
Well,
that is
happening, and it's a bias. And we'd even say, like, you a disdain almost. Like it's close to a disdain. We're like, I'm gonna take someone, I'm gonna take a shot across the pond and lose a bunch of money, even though it might be cheaper. But no, it is something to ponder on and to look at the future. And it is something like Moneyball in MLS, how to use Moneyball and how to use advanced analytics or just scouting resources in a way to get an advantage versus your competitors in Major League Soccer. Maybe looking at USL players is one of these venues, of these avenues to get better as a club. Speaking of getting better as a club, the Montreal Impact yesterday announced their full staff. We knew Thierry Henry, their biggest acquisition so far. You would say that it is their manager. Thierry Henry is their manager. His staff will be completed by assistant coach Kwame Ampadu, who is a former assistant with Monaco in France when Henry was there, and he has his UFAA license. He also worked at the Arsenal FC Academy. You also have Jules Guéguen, Wilfried Nancy, who was assistant coach with the Impact, and he's returning. Patrice Bernier also coming back as an assistant, and Rémi Vercoute coming back as goalkeeper coach of the Montreal Impact. This is the 2020 Montreal Impact coaching staff.
Yeah, and look, you always know that you're going to bring guys from your former teams in there. I suspect that Henri has surrounded himself with people that he feels comfortable, that can handle a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of the day-to-day technical stuff that he is, I think, probably in his own mind would be inexperienced at the very least. I mean, it's hard not to be inexperienced at it. He has only done it for a year or so. So obviously he's surrounded himself there. It's nice that Patrice Bernier is still on that staff and that he recognizes the importance of having some local connections and someone who probably understands, you know, the entire system better than he would coming in. All this is good stuff. We'll can't wait to see them get going, to be honest, because it's going to be, I think, a really interesting year in Montreal in terms of what kind of stamp Henry puts on this club that had a disappointing 2019, but I think a lot of people thought that there might be some potential there. So it's going to be an interesting sort of experience to watch this play out, and it gets going pretty quick. So, good that we have the staff named. Henri had a great little hipster toque on there when he was being photographed in the Impact office. I like that. He's been hanging out in Brooklyn a little bit, I think. So good for him.
Patrice Bernier's run DMC Adidas jersey was pretty damn sweet too. But before we say goodbye, it is a super draft today, the super conference call. We're not going to go deep into it. We went into it yesterday with Travis. But Dwayne, if you have to address one concern about Toronto FC with the super draft, one position that might be needed, which one would you try to fill with the super conference call later today?
TFC is, you know, they went to the championship game. We're one of the better teams down the half. They're not a team that has major issues at this point. I think everyone understands that they would like to add some depth out wide. I think people understand that they're trying to move Alex Bono, whether they can or not to question, but if they do move that, they might need a backup keeper. I think you probably look at those as positions, wide positions, whether they be fullbacks or wingers, and perhaps a backup keeper to allow you to then move the $400,000 lump of coal sitting on your bench. I say that with all due respect, Alex. That's the areas I would look at most consistently there. If I was going to extend this to the other Canadian team we cover, the Whitecaps, I think really with them, they're the opposite of TSC. They take the best talent that's out there. And, there's some suggestions that the Canadian in the draft has followed them on Twitter today. So perhaps that's where they're going, but we'll see.
Ryan Raposo, a Generation Adidas Canadian player. And if I have to address the Montreal Impact, I would see if I can find defenders either by drafting or maybe in another form of player movement, trade, or an acquisition, getting someone's rights. Montreal needs defenders right now.
Yeah, there's only a few in the roster. What, four?
Five.
It's five. So, you know, but really only a couple that are what you would call a muscle caliber.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I think the conversation we had with Jed, the reason I booked Jeff for today and Travis yesterday, obviously we wanted to talk about the players that were coming in, but I thought Jeff was a valuable conversation to have today because it does illustrate
that the draft still has some value because for better or worse, teams view these guys as clean slates that they can bring in and control. And rather than go into the USL to find these players that are more developed, they are going to take these guys. So, you know, there will be 10 or so. Well, there were 17 last year. I think they got minutes that were drafted, which is higher than normal, to be honest. But, you know, some of those minutes are five, right? So it's not really something that's...
5 minutes at the end of a game against, like, Columbus and from the 85th to the 90th minute, like a very, very useful 5 minutes.
Precisely, yeah. There's a few that have just sort of touched the field to kill time, basically. But yeah, you will have some back-end roster spots filled out today, particularly the top five. And look, when I used to run these numbers, Kevin, as a final thought on this, on the draft, the conference call, the super Slack, the super Skype, whatever they're going to call it, I would always find that in any given year, there were between like 2-3 in a bad year and 4-5 in a good year of players that had over the course of their career a somewhat significant impact. And when I used to do a thing on Canadian Soccer News where I would classify these players into several different categories, you know, exceptional was the top one. And what that simply meant was that these are guys that played. When I called a guy an exceptional player, well, I'll give you an example. Chad Barrett was an exceptional player based on the criteria that I did. And Chad, because he was a starter, he played regularly in MLS. And that's, I think, an important lesson to remember. That is your best case scenario. You are not going to get a superstar out of these drafts. You're not. Maybe the last one that was drafted might have been Adu, you know, and that he wasn't a superstar in the sense of that he played a significant impact within MLS, but he did sell for quite a bit. Generally speaking, the best you can hope for is to get a guy, Sam Cronin, just get a guy like that.
Yeah, he was
play a long, successful career.
Yeah, they're good examples, and we'll see if there's any of these players pick this year. The Super Draft airs today on MLSsoccer.com. It is going to be a different format, and we'll have more to talk about tomorrow on Soccer Today, the world of football with a soccer perspective. You can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute, myself at Kev Larme, and this show at Soccer Today SPN Live, Monday to Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific. You can find our premium podcast at patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork for $2, $5, and $10 a month. And we'll be back tomorrow. And until then, have a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.